throughout the world the normal, there is a tendency to assume that the actual intellectual life of man began not more than 5,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era. Behind this date, it is assumed that man was slowly emerging from savagery. This is a very interesting point of view, and one that probably will not be entirely clarified for a long time. The story, however, as we now have it and believe it, is not entirely convincing. Man's sudden emergence into an intellectual life is rather too rapid. The measures of his early achievements rather too prodigious. And it is difficult to imagine that the builder of the Pyramid of Cheops simply had an extraordinary idea all by himself and created the finished product without the knowledge and skills which it is now rather obvious were necessary for its accomplishment. We go to the East, and in Asia we find evidence of a great learning emerging from behind the dark curtain of history. Where this learning came from, we do not really know. But it seems extremely doubtful that human culture, human progress, has existed for such a short period of time as we commonly think. And in my estimations a few moments ago, I was very, very generous in terms of modern thinking. Most moderns will not permit nearly the time span which I have intimated. Yet in India, there is no doubt that the philosophical systems have a much larger concept of the universe, a concept that was certainly most thrilling to an open and intelligent mind from the rest, a concept which opened a great many doors to a new appraisal of the entire history of man and his relationship with nature. We have every evidence in ancient Indian writings, traditions, and legends that these people were firmly convinced that human culture goes back an incredible period of time so far as our thinking is concerned. They were also quite convinced that the present pattern of culture or civilization is not the only one that has existed, and that somewhere under the ruins of things, perhaps too fragile to leave important records or important developments within rock stratification and so forth, there were great cultures, great civilizations of long ago that vanished away in the dawn of time, and for which we have no historical account or record today. The old Hindus certainly believed this. And in the rather contagious atmosphere of their approach to life, it was possible to have a great many interesting ideas spring into your own mind. The East Indian position opened the way to a complete reappraisal of Western thinking, an appraisal based on the total heritage of man rather than upon the heritage of a single civilization or hemisphere. Let us then assume that in Hindu astronomy we present to the consideration of Western man a concept of magnitudes not available to our way of life except in the last two or three centuries. even in the days of Columbus, we did not have any adequate comprehension of the world in which we belonged. Yet there is no question that the ancient Hindus did possess a knowledge which was useful and practical relating to these matters. One point I think we have to bear in mind in connection with Eastern philosophy, though it may appear to be extremely accurate in many ways, it was never especially dogmatic. Both Hinduism and Buddhism frankly admitted that all words used to express ideas must be accepted as symbols rather than as identical with facts. Words were not used to completely expose meaning. They were used to suggest meaning. It was assumed that to go beyond this point was to step outside of a reasonable province of man. Why should we express exact meaning and imply that we do when we do not possess such meaning? Why should we try to take an absolute stand in a world in which we have only relative knowledge? The ancient person, therefore, was inclined to be rather modest in his pretensions about knowledge. He did not expect the great concepts which he expounded to be accepted literally, to be regarded as hard and fast facts somewhere in space. They were improvisations upon a cosmic theme. The full theme man did not understand, and may not for a long time. And therefore all dogmatism does little more than paralyze progress by locking men's minds in attitudes that are not final, and therefore which cannot be defended as final. But in their astronomy, the Hindus took it for granted beyond any question that the entire field of space was not only alive, but was ensouled by consciousness. The creation is an expression of consciousness. That all things as we know them arose in the divine nature, just as thoughts, ideas, inventions arise in human nature. To these people, therefore, there had to be an infinite consciousness. There had to be something so vast that it extended beyond the galaxy, that the whole pattern of the Milky Way with its millions of suns was only an incident in this consciousness, that it went on and on beyond conceivable time and space, in that which is timeless and spaceless. It proceeded from that which is finite to infinity, in all directions, and in every quality. It not only extended in terms of area, but it extended in terms of internal structure, so that the innermost parts of things were as far from our present knowledge as the outermost parts. The immensity within life is reflected in the immensity outside of living organisms. Everything, therefore, was a vast unfoldment of infinite consciousness. This infinite consciousness, by virtue of its own infinity, could conceive, generate, produce, and form anything that arose within its own nature. It therefore could produce an incredible diversity of creations, adjusting each to the circumstances of its own nature, adjusting each
to the great cycles of evolutionary process which permeated and sustained the entire pattern. This consciousness also contained within its own nature the mystery of all forms of consciousness conditioned and dependent upon the cosmic mind itself. Therefore, within consciousness was mind, which is subservient to consciousness. Within consciousness and mind is feeling, which is subservient to them. And throughout all creation, life moves into activity, which again is a lesser manifestation of consciousness itself. Thus, we think of one consciousness, one life, one existence, one origin, one means, one end. All enveloped within so intricate and inconceivable a patternry that the human mind simply cannot grasp it. So the old Hindus were satisfied to simply create word pictures to give some idea of what it really could be, might be, must be. But they would not dogmatize. They would not attempt to declare what was in divine consciousness, what it intended, how it intended to manifest itself, or what its ultimate goals might be. These were too great for the human intellect to cope with. In addition, therefore, to the problem of consciousness itself, must be considered the means by which consciousness was able to administer this vastness. A vastness which, as we suggest, is not to be conceived by man. More suns, worlds, globes in space than there are grains of sand upon the earth. And each one of these globes and each one of these grains of sand, a living thing. For everything that exists, exists because of life, and because it partakes in universal life. Therefore, this universal life must not only be infinite in its power, but it must be able to incline itself to the contemplation of the most minute, the most inconceivably small of all living things. And here we have this brilliant, this magnificent, this incredible structure, which to the ancient Eastern people constituted the anatomy and physiology of the Absolute. From the first of these speculations, therefore, we gain one concept, which was to find its way into theosophy. And that is the realization of what may be considered an acceptable concept of God. God as infinite life, infinite consciousness, infinite mind. God not as a person, but something that transcends person, yet is capable of producing personalities out of itself on the lower levels of its own manifestation. But this infinite is a being, an essence, a substance, but not a person. Yet it is deficient in no attribute that we can assume a person can possess. Because all persons, no matter how exalted they may be, in our imagination, even up to the throne of deity itself, all persons are but partial manifestations of the infinite. All personality is a conditioned release of energy, which exists completely, perfectly and inevitably in the unconditioned. This unconditioned may properly be termed Atman. It may be properly considered to be life held in common by everything that lives. It may also be regarded as an essence, being, or substance so infinite that man can never outgrow it, can never so highly evolve any part of his own consciousness that he can transcend the fact of consciousness. No matter how he uses consciousness, he can never come to the point where he can declare this consciousness to be unreal, or to be merely an aspect of something still greater. Consciousness per se is that which is shared by all things, great and not great. All things come from it, all things return to it. And in Indian philosophy, consciousness itself is the only immortal, the only eternal, the only reality that is unborn and cannot die. Now, the Hindu says this perhaps with his fingers crossed. For actually, he does not know whether it could be born or whether it could die. He only knows that in terms of his own comprehension, it is inconceivable. Beyond this, he can only wait until some mysterious power in the process of infinite growth releases the truth into manifestation for him. So we now have a universe in which the most positive and ultimate pole is consciousness. The infinitely negative pole is matter, and there is actually no difference between the two. For matter is only a mode of consciousness. Matter is only one of the infinite thought forms that arise in the infinite consciousness. Matter is not something left out. It is not an adversary. It is not a negation. It is simply a condition. Now, if we could penetrate matter, we would discover that the more deeply we entered into the mystery of matter, the more rapidly we would approach the true fact of consciousness. For consciousness is at the root of matter, even as it is in the absolute extensions of space. This realization of one life was perhaps originally scientific, and the Brahman mind was astonishingly capable of scientific thinking to the degree that science is possible, but it was never obsessed with the idea that mind could master all things. The Brahman was never certain that he could know all, or all that he knew was knowledge. He could only go as far as he could, and then admit that from that point on he was ignorant. And it was that last admission that saved him, because he was never involved in absolute dogmatism the way Western thinkers have become involved. The next point that is of importance in this consideration is the second great hypothesis, namely that consciousness, in its infinite manifestation, reveals an absolute plan. Consciousness, whatever it may be, contains within itself and stamped within every fragment of itself a pattern. A pattern of process. The motion of the infinite toward the finite and its final involvement in finiteness. And the ultimate motion of consciousness from this involvement back again to its own pure state. Processes that we call involution and evolution, borrowing from the thinking of 19th century European minds like Herbert Spencer. These processes are orderly, lawful, and inevitable. Therefore, the whole of space is permeated not only by consciousness, but by consciousness purposed. It has a reason. It has a cause for its own existence. It has a destiny within itself that must ultimately be revealed. This destiny locked within consciousness itself is the only valid destiny. It has never been true and never will be true that man has the right to create a destiny. He has only the right, through the unfolding of consciousness, to become aware of destiny. All action, therefore, that is valid, all learning that is valid, must be founded in the awareness of the purposes of consciousness and the message or meaning or substance of knowledge which consciousness contains. Consciousness is therefore identical in itself with law. Law and consciousness are co-eternal and can never be separated from each other in the smallest particular or for the slightest instant of time. Law is actually the way consciousness works, and we have no redress from it at any time, under any condition. We can never ask for it to be varied or violated, because we have no power with which to cope with lawfulness. It is within us just as surely as consciousness is within us. It is conveyed to us by every ray of the sun. It is revealed to us by every alternation of the seasons. Every process in the infinite is infinitely lawful. So we have a strange and wonderful condition of eternal awareness of what it is aware we do not know. If it is aware of itself, the Hindu assumes that it is then introverted in rest. If it becomes aware of the not-self, it is then extroverted into the process of creation. And this process of creation and return to the uncreated represents the great tidal motion in consciousness, the tidal motion of ebbing and flowing, of becoming revealed and becoming hidden again, of moving from rest to activity, and passing from activity to rest again. So the Hindu now has a universe composed of two equally valid things which are one in essence: consciousness and the method or means by which consciousness operates. This method or means being innate, inevitable, and coeval with that which manifests through it. Thus we suddenly come into the presence of universal law. And universal law, in turn, reminds us of the relationship of man-made law to the infinite, and reminds us that the only valid relationship is that man must obey, and that all human laws must be based upon divine or universal law, or they are not valid. The third value or power that rests within the nature of infinite consciousness itself is volition. Consciousness moves. Consciousness causes to arise within its own unconditioned existence certain conditioned states. Some Indian systems of philosophy assume that volition is identical with consciousness, is also eternal, and that the processes of arising within consciousness are also eternal. But there is never an instant, never a time, when the real manifestation of consciousness is not also operating. Therefore, consciousness is eternally creative, causing to arise out of itself innumerable conditioned aspects of itself. In this way, so to say, following the law of the planting and the reaping of grain upon the earth, so that the processes of creation are forever producing a harvest and a multiplication of the seed, so that the harvest is enriched tenfold. This volitional power also rests within everything which is by nature a part of this cosmic system. And that means, literally and actually, everything. Consequently, all natures have within themselves the volitional power to grow. And this volitional power also includes the generative power to procreate, to reproduce, to perpetuate kind and species. This process of infinite perpetuation being obvious in space as well as in the ordinary affairs of the animal and vegetable kingdoms. Out of all of this, therefore, there comes the essential concept of an eternal symbolic being, ever in meditation, seated eternally in the adamantine posture of the Buddha. A being always and eternally in a strange kind of contemplative existence, dreaming forth worlds, conjuring up in meditations all of this vast pageantry of existence, which is suspended upon the impulses of will and yoga. This infinite meditating power, Adi Buddha, the primordial, the power of the consciousness and of the mind, which in the course of time will come forth from this infinite being. The infinite meditator produces from meditation that which apparently is distinct from itself, individuality. Individuality, therefore, is not at the apex. It is a conditioned expression, as Pythagoras was aware. The eternal meditator produces, therefore, from meditation, beings that exist with a certain sense of individuality, beings in whom the infinite unity is obscured, but who still participate in the volitional power to become, to attain certain things, and are therefore the powers that set up the world. Of these volitional beings, the highest are those which we call deities. This term being given to the first man-born progeny of the infinite, being born of the mind of the infinite. They possess an essence which is of the nature of mind. But locked within this essence is also the life power of consciousness itself. But the mind born cannot explore consciousness by mental power. Therefore, as was referred to in the Eddas and Sagas of the Scandinavian legend, the deity Odin, representing cosmic mind, was able to know all secrets except the secret of his own origin and his own destiny. These he could not know. So the great generation of the mind born actually begin the population of the firmament. And from these mind-born descend all the orders of life possessing mind, or possessing manas, or possessing the attributes of the thinker. Now the mind-born have had a rather rocky and difficult time of it. Because actually, it is the destiny of all things that are essentially the progeny of mind that they must remain unaware or ignorant of their own origin, of the substance of themselves. They can penetrate only a little distance into their own nature, and then they are blocked by the instrument which they have to use for penetration. For the mind cannot transcend itself, nor can it know that which cannot be contained within the experience of mentality. Thus the deities of ancient times established somewhere in space the beginning of worship. And even in the oldest records that we know, it was held and affirmed that the gods of high Olympus and equally high Nero still pay homage to the infinite principle at the source of themselves. And they represented this infinite principle by various symbols, by regalias, by the establishment of priesthoods, the concept being capable of a brief summation thus, that the mind can explore that which is available to intellect, but beyond that which is available, there can only be belief, faith, and acceptance. So the highest attribute of the mind born is faith in that which transcends itself. Thus it is the duty and responsibility, the opportunity and privilege of the mind born to affirm the existence of consciousness, although the mind of itself cannot directly experience this. And after every effort to utterly define it is to defy it in some way. It follows, therefore, that there has been this division set up in the very process of creation itself, dividing all things into those that can know and those that cannot know. Also, it is recognized and realized that the amount that can be known is enlarged by the process of evolution and growth. That there are ways by which the individual can extend knowledge. That it is possible for him to gradually eliminate some of the interval of not knowing for the purpose of gaining full insight into the responsibilities and obligations of his own existence. Man is not supposed to learn either to justify or console himself, nor is he to learn on the presumption that by learning is going to take over the mastery of creation. He is supposed to learn in order that he may gradually come into a fuller insight into the plane to which he belongs, and therefore more capable of voluntary cooperation with that plane. Thus, the degree of knowledge and the degree of not knowing differs with different forms of life. And in the Eastern system, it is assumed that there are many ways of knowing other than those ways known to man. And the fact that a creature is not equipped to use such methods as we possess in no way implies that that creature cannot know. It simply means that it has other bridges between itself and necessary knowledge. In man's affairs, we have observed that there are really two forms of knowledge, other than those which are traditional or are developed and passed on from one generation to another. One of these forms is instinct, and the other is intuition. Instinct is a term which we apply to ways of finding out about things without mind, or with a kind of mind that we regard as unequipped or unable to rationalize. Intuition is a term which we apply to processes that transcend the mind, or seem to cause it to extend further into the unknown than might reasonably be expected. Intuition, of course, is the subconscious process of becoming gradually aware of the universe that extends beyond mind, and in the course of time, gaining certain rudimentary insight as to the probabilities of this larger region. Now, the gods in Indian philosophy, which are the mind-born of the meditating power, represent those forces which are peculiarly related to the manifestation of created patterns in space. Gods represent units of mind within which worlds are evolved. These mental units must enclose, at least psychologically, their creations. For each creation must be subservient to its own creating power. Thus, Hinduism gives us another valuable pattern upon which to build, namely, that the eternal consciousness in manifesting its infinite diversity of forms must do so by means of hierarchy. In other words, the various steps of creation must be assigned to units of intelligence capable of performing these specified duties. It is consequently assumed that the universe is a vast order of life ruled over by a vast hierarchy of beings. These beings arising as impermanent images within the nature of the unconditioned consciousness space itself. All of these gods, so-called, are capable of birth and capable of dissolution. The only thing that cannot be dissolved is consciousness itself. Thus, none of the manifestations of consciousness can be eternal. But in terms of human experience, man knows that they can extend for vast aeons of time, to be measured in billions of years, and in billions of light years as far as distances are concerned. Yet although to us such vast beings, the great stars, and those powers even beyond stars which are invisible to us, that are infinitely greater than any galaxy that we can contemplate, all of these are subject to dissolution, and must, according to the great cycles to which they belong, pass through the mystery of sleeping and waking, and of life and death, like all other created things. For as the ancient Jewish prophet said, "Oh, it is only the Lord God of Israel who neither slumbers nor sleeps." It is consciousness itself that alone passes through no process of losing its own nature or regaining it. But the loss of selfhood and the regaining of selfhood can exist within it, but it cannot itself be lost, divided, or cease for one instant in its own awareness of its own being. And if we wish to assume this concept to be more or less the idea behind Indian philosophy of the universe, and that this process takes place within vast cycles of time running into billions of years, and that all the different levels of the cosmos have their own cycles, their own time periods, which are to us immensities beyond calculation, then we have what might be termed the great machinery of the cosmos. We have a machinery which, according to the Eastern mind, is ensouled with life. The final proof of this ensoulment being the fact that it is alive. And that in the very process of becoming alive, it becomes subservient to the infinite laws of life and generation, so that all of this vast progeny in space unfolds, grows, matures, fulfills its destiny in a perfectly orderly and completely purposeful manner. Now, this might be considered a very brief summary of the psychocosmical process. But we know that out of this, later, rose the other system of thinking to which modern Blavatsky was most addicted, and that was Mahayana Buddhism. We know definitely that Buddha himself had available to him these great universal concepts of Hinduism. Because he possessed this as a natural birthright, being of princely origin and belonging to the caste of the warriors, Gautama Buddha was naturally instructed in this ancient lore, and so were most of those early companions who formed the first cycle of the patriarchs and the arhats. Just as most of the early Christians were derived from Orthodox Jewish backgrounds, so most of the early Buddhists were born of Hindu families, trained and raised in Hinduism. Consequently, they shared together this kind of an attitude toward life. It was this basic information, which they did share in common, that probably did the most to protect early Buddhism from some of the pitfalls that have been so detrimental to other religions that did not have an adequate grasp of universal immensities. Our modern astronomers today would probably regard the Hindu position as almost ultra-conservative. They would say that it is even bigger than India anciently thought it was. But even the modern astronomer, with all his discoveries, cannot outwit the moral implications of the Hindu theology. Astronomy has not been able to prove or demonstrate that consciousness does not exist. It has not found any other answer to take the place of the great concept of Eastern mysticism. Modern astronomy is satisfied to try to explain the nebula hypothesis, prove it or refute it. It is satisfied to explore slowly and painfully the substances of the astronomical diffusion. But even today, after thousands of years, the astronomer cannot actually find serious fault with the Hindu thinking. In some way, long ago, intuitively at least, these Eastern peoples hit upon the one tremendous fact of immensity. They realized that the universe was not merely one little solar system. And they also realized that whatever the divine power was that ruled all things could not simply be locked up within the structure of a single planet or develop itself harmoniously in the atmosphere of a single religion. These things could not be. This does not prove the religions were wrong. It proves, however, they got themselves into trouble by making God too small, by accepting something that would be violently opposed by the progress of knowledge and for which they had no adequate explanation. Buddhism escaped this along with Hinduism. And that is the reason why the impact of Western knowledge upon British countries has caused no religious upheaval. These countries were perfectly willing to accept it. If they had the wrong shape of the world at some other time and had it square instead of round, and wiser people knew it was round, the Buddhist made it his round without any apology to anybody. Because he had never actually claimed to know its shape. He created symbols for it. He will be always willing to take the most approved shape now. But if in the future they change that, he will change again. He will never be locked within an ancient concept which he cannot outgrow. The only concept he will accept is this infinite consciousness unfolding forever. Out of this concept, of course, gradually developed the magnificent vision that is found in the Sutra of the Lotus of the True Law. Here this great Hindu system is suddenly transposed to the Buddhist level to become a great Buddhist system. Here all the gods of Hinduism become Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, or guardian deities of the Buddhist doctrine. One of the interesting points that Buddhism pointed out in the Northern School is that the gods, whether they be Brahma or Shiva or any of the deities of Hinduism, must also learn what they already do not know. Namely, that they are thoughts in the divine mind, just as man is. And that actually, what they term gods are not really gods at all. They are just consciousness growing up in space. And man and the gods are a single fabric, with the gods as elder brothers and men as younger brothers. But nor should we assume deities to be special creations, separate from law, or capable of breaking law any more than the humblest atom can do so. gradually, in the process of its development, Northern Buddhism adopted most of the gods and gave them a larger education toward the further enlightenment of their own beings. And we therefore find the story, as referred to in many of the ancient carvings, of the deities Brahma and Indra seated at the feet of Buddha receiving instruction. Why? Not because an historical Buddha instructed them, but because, like all other things and all other beings, they had to finally sit at the feet of consciousness and learn the ineffables, which as separate beings they could not completely understand. Buddhism consequently suddenly populated the firmament with a new kind of being called a Buddha. And never at any time were these Buddhas gods. They were always and forever simply part of the great creation growing up. They were orders of life, legitimate orders, evolving from the lowest to the highest, along with everything that existed. And here we do have a hint of the meaning of the Greek concept of heroes. When man proceeds one further step, he will obtain heroic consciousness, which is the consciousness of the Arhat. The Arhat being the sage. The Arhat being in Buddhism, the one who has accepted the doctrine and is resolved to perfect his own nature. This, therefore, represents another order of life. Man, below him the animal, above him the Arhat. And while, as far as can be perceived, the Arhat resembles man, except in oriental art he is usually a bit eccentric in representation, he is a strange, wild being, dedicated mysteriously to truth alone. So when the individual enters the dedication to the search for understanding in order that he may completely obey, he becomes the Arhat, or the one worthy of respect, for he is striving to obtain cosmic usefulness. And as the Arhat is above man, so in the northern system, the next order above the Arhat is the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is separate from the Arhat only in one essential particular, and that is the vow of service. The Arhat, having reached a certain degree of development, either chooses to retire into the Paramibbana, or else to sacrifice this in order to become a servant of man. If the Arhat takes the Bodhisattva vow of renunciation, renouncing his own perfection or his own return to consciousness, in order that he may assist all other suffering creatures to attain consciousness, that he may go in with them but never before them. If he attains this, if he achieves this, he is then a Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva may, however, be a long time in attaining to the full measure of his enlightenment. But after the taking of a vow, he must continue until he culminates that vow. And it is assumed that he can only achieve the ultimate goal which he intends to achieve when there is actually a Buddha alive and embodied in the world.